Hello and welcome to Skeleton Songs.
Ongs, ongs, ongs.
Yeah, we're going to do our own effects now because we don't have any budget for this. So,
and that was sort of a reference to the subject of this podcast I just did, but it wasn't a very good reference.
We're not doing an episode on like spooky ghost bells, although we should do one on spooky
ghost
bells.
What are we doing an episode on, Lottie Bevan?
I believe we're doing an episode, Alexis, on apophenia.
Apophenia? Tell me more about apophenia.
Well, it's something that I think anybody who has read any of our stuff before will have come across. And it's something that we talk about quite a bit in relation to our game Cultist Simulator. But it has, because it's a fancy Greek word, it has a lot of history and a lot of complicated things about it that we think are interesting. So apophenia originally was coined by a sadly Nazi psychiatrist in the 50s.
Was he sad about being a Nazi, or he said that he was a Nazi?
Well, history does not relate. I mean, he vacationally joined the Nazi party, so I assume that he was kind of chill. But then lots of people joined the Nazi party who probably did it because they thought they had to. So who knows? But the point is, this gentleman called Klaus Conrad published a paper about the early symptoms of schizophrenia. And within that paper, he coined the term apophenia, which he used to describe basically humans seeing patterns where there aren't any specific patterns, and then applying what he called brilliantly abnormal meaning to those patterns. Mm-hmm. So one non-medical example of apophenia might be when you look at a car and you see the bumpers and the headlights are arranged in such a way that it reminds you of a face, and the car looks angry or happy or whatever. And there's subreddits dedicated to basically photos of inanimate objects that look like they have faces, and I am a happy member of many of them. But that would be fairly benign because you're not kind of applying abnormal meaning to that. You're just thinking, lol, that car looks like it has a face. And at the more medical end of it, you end up with the kind of classic symptoms of paranoid schizophrenia. So you get basically a sufferer applying meaning and seeing patterns in the chaos. So they might, for example, hear a bird cheep in a tree and think that that was a sign from God telling them that they shouldn't go out today or something. And then they would build up layers of meaning on top of those patterns that they themselves had imposed upon things that weren't really there. And they might end up believing things like the classic, you know, the government's coming to get me, or I'm the chosen one of God. And they would have this sort of daily proof because of their own pattern recognition that had gone slightly awry. And to be clear, you know, we do use pattern recognition as a really constant function of like daily cognitive functioning, right? So we use patterns to recognize people's faces whom we know. We use patterns to know what is appropriate in social situations. We use patterns to recognize hazards when we're driving a car. I mean, the huge amount of our brain's functioning is dependent on the human body recognizing different patterns in different situations. So all of this is a very positive, normal thing. But sometimes it can basically be cranked up to 11 and have some pretty interesting consequences. And this means that we have quite a lot of interesting opportunities in art to do some pretty interesting things, which I think, Alexis, is where you come in.
It is, but I was also going to share some etymology facts.
Ooh, etymology, etymology.
So
etymology.
Apophenia etymology. Is a word now everyone is familiar with.
It's Greek.
But I don't know if everyone knows its allied word. So you know what an epiphany is?
Oh, epiphany. Okay, so epiphany is a sudden revelation.
Yes. Sort of flash of insight in which, you know, you connect to God, or you understand calculus, or you realise that your wife is a werewolf or whatever. And
I've been telling you that for years.
Werewife.
Oh, yeah.
Girls
becoming brides. Brides becoming wolves.
I just do this the rest of the episode.
Sorry, I'll stop interrupting. I'm high on Lemsip.
Yeah, Lottie's not well, poor love.
It's okay. I'll get through it.
Anyway, no, but I was seriously listening to you do the wolf bar mitzvah feminine version. Feminist version, I'm sorry. Apophony.
Is that really a word?
Apophony. Apophony is a word. So if you have an epiphany, then you realise something that is, we assume, true.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have an apophany, then you have a moment of what feels like understanding, but probably isn't understanding, because you connected things that aren't really connected. And it's often, as Nazi Klaus would point out, the prelude to a breakdown. I'm so sorry.
I know. I'm sorry that I introduced him as Nazi Klaus. Or someone did. It is my fault. I take it back.
But the other thing about Nazi Klaus is that he...
No!
The other thing about...
Mr. Conrad, as he will now be known.
Herr Dr. Conrad.
No!
The head doctor is perfectly...
I know, but it's a bit laden with cultural stereotypes, isn't
I
it?
I mean, maybe it's time to clean those cultural stereotypes out of our ears and eyes.
Tell me about Mr. Conrad.
Head Dr. Conrad pointed out that... Sorry, he coined this term, apophenia. And the etymology of it seems confusing, because apo is the same apo as in apocalypse. It means like sort of...
I was going to ask that.
Yeah, it's
I think I'll ask that one per episode.
So because it's like a sort of particle that goes at the beginning of lots of meanings, but it means sort of like a pass or removing or from or away from. But the phenia bit, it could be from phanein, I can't remember, which means something like to appear. But what he probably meant was phrenia, which is in schizophrenia, which is the brain, the mind. So probably means something
mean,
like...
Sorry?
Apo means sort of being separated from or taken away or...
Well, actually, he might... Because it's funny that you mentioned it was Fane, because I, in our newsletter that's going out later today, ladies and gentlemen, I was looking at the Orphic god Phanes.
Yeah.
Phanes, he's a primordial god in Orphic tradition, other than Cronus, whom we don't talk about. And that is specifically defined as the sort of bringer of light or the light, the sort of elucidator.
We've run up against the limits of my Greek, which are extremely narrow limits. And we need Matt really here to tell us whether or not Phanes the god and Phanein the verb are related. But it sounds to me like they might be.
But yes, I interrupted your etymological...
Oh, that's it, I finished. No, you made me sound smarter than I am because we got to the end of it. So yeah, the etymology is it's not really clear. And this is sort of... a really apophenian thing in itself, really. What's the story here? Did he misspell it? Did he intentionally mean to reference Phanes rather than...
I mean, I suspect because, you know, as far as I can tell, he had a sort of brilliant medical career and was obviously quite groundbreaking in his study, that he did not make a mistake with his coinage of a term that became very significant. I mean, it's always possible because humans are, you know, deeply fallible, but...
Well, you say that, but in fact, and this wasn't rehearsed.
Oh, this is a gotcha.
This is an unexpected apophenic connection.
It. Fell in the hole.
Another friend. Was he German, Jung? Austrian, Swiss, German? I kind of think he was Swiss, German, but let's say German. So, Jung, Herr Doktor Jung, who was, as far
God
as we know,
sake.
In no way a Nazi. Jung was... Another brilliant German medico. There seem to be a lot of brilliant German medicos. And he may or may not also been barking mad, of course, but he...
I do have some issues with his modern psychology, I'll be honest.
So he got very interested, as you might expect, in the Orphic stuff.
I also came across him in my newsletter.
And I was reading about a obscure... god called, I think, Ericopaos, for some of the lore design for Book of Hours.
Our upcoming game, listed on Steam.
And Ericopaos is another facet of Phanes, or he might be another god who sort of like Phanes, and all this sort of stuff comes down in fragments. And Ericopaos is one of those annoying words whose etymology is completely bewildering and unclear. And the thing is about it, so there's a language called Ericopaean in Book of Hours, and I said to Lottie when I put it in the game, don't worry about misspelling this or spelling it differently, because you still, I think, struggle with scholarcosphy, reasonably.
I do. We suspect that I'm a minor dyslexic, despite the fact that I think
but scholarcosophy
myself
is also quite
a literary person, and it's quite frustrating to live with Alexis, who's like, yes, the etymology of this, and I famously never spell a word wrong, and
wrong. I can't spell diarrhea, usually. Always.
Okay, we're going to get away from this topic.
Yeah, scholarcosophy is a difficult one. Anyway, but Erica, so even Jung couldn't spell Ericopaos.
Oh, really?
There's this whole bit he did about how he kept writing it down in his journals and he kept misspelling it.
Oh, that's really funny.
And then he met a woman who told him about a dream she'd had about a god called, and she'd spelt it like Ericopaos. rather than Ericopaeus, and it was the same spelling he'd done, so this was synchronicity and so determined meaning in it.
Interesting, so, really. So that became the sort of definitive one because two people happened to spell it wrong the same way.
And I don't think it became a definitive one, and I'll never remember
so
now which the definitive
of human
one
history.
Is. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I think, you know, people freaking misspell shit or get shit wrong all the time. You know, one of my very favourite, and again, you see apophenia everywhere you look, but this is a slightly peculiar thing. One of my favourite historical factoids about translation that's then but actually on the back of it is, have I told this one on the podcast before? I tell it so often I feel like I might have, but I'm going to plunge ahead anyway. Zhu Enlai, who was the premier of the People's Republic of China in Mao's time, was speaking in France, and he was asked the United Nations, I don't know, it doesn't matter, he was asked about France, and he was asked what the significance of the French Revolution was, and he replied, it's too early to tell. And
very good answer.
A very good answer. And obviously this plays into the reputation that China has in the West, and Zhu Enlai had personally, of being kind of mystical and apothebic, I guess, and epigrammatical. And people say, oh, you know, the Chinese just think on different scales from us in the West. And I've read this point made dozens of times. So that may be true. It may be that Zhu and I really did think on a different scale. It may be that's even an explicitly Chinese thing, although those are both quite big leaps to take. But it seems that when he was asked this question, it was in around about 1969, 1970. And in 1968, they just had all the revolts and demonstrations in Paris in the Parisian Spring. And it seems that it quite likely that Enlai thought he was being asked about the disturbances in Paris in 1968 rather than the one in the 18th century, which would have been a reasonable sort of question to ask a politician a year and a half after they'd happened. And it's too early to tell. It's quite a reasonable thing to say a year and a half on. Yeah. Umberto Eco.
Does he have something to say about apophenia?
Because
at some
does.
Point we're going to have to mention some games, otherwise we are lying to our listeners.
Well, there's sort of a game in this book that he wrote. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Foucault's Pendulum.
Yep.
So Foucault's Pendulum is basically about apophenia. And because it's Eco, it's sort of, to say it's basically about anything is a bit of a trap, and it can basically turn out to be something else if you look at it a different way. But these acquaintances start getting interested in the Knights Templar and in conspiracy theories and in connections. And they end up building an elaborate LOL conspiracy theory using some sort of procedural generation on a home PC to put together a whole bunch of unrelated facts. And it comes up with a completely new, non-existent secret society, the TREZ, which is short for some fantastic elaborate name, and then they become convinced that this is real, and that, you know, it's just happened that the computer has stumbled across a real conspiracy and randomly generated something that's identical to the real thing, and that the TREZ are trying to take control of the Omphalos, the navel of the world, so they can control the telluric currents that manipulate like society and the land, and then one of the folks becomes convinced that he's actually one of them, and people end up hiding in museums and interrogating each other, and it all gets rather out of hand. But by the end of the book, it is still by no means clear whether everything is just people getting overexcited or whether there's really something going on, which makes it quite a frustrating book for those of us who like traditional narrative, but quite a good book for those of who want to quote things about apophenia.
And when was it written? Ish?
90s, I want to say. It was 90s. After Name of the Rose. It was, okay. I think, his next one after Name of the Rose.
Because I'm afraid he's following a very strong tradition of apophenia in literature.
Tell me about that in a moment, but I want to get the quote out.
Okay.
And the quote is just that any fact is important when it's connected to another fact. And I think you, the listener, this is your time to interact with this podcast. Pay attention to where your hands are. Don't move them unless there's something really awkward. Leave your hands where they are. Take the note of where your left forefinger is. So there is a point in space where the left forefinger is. It's quite hard to assign any significance to that point in space. It's just probably like on your knee or up your nose. And it's probably not up your nose. I apologise for doubting you. And now take a note of where your right forefinger is. And now draw an imaginary line between those two and extend it in both directions. And you'll notice it's much more easy to imagine or assign meaning to that line, because the line on my fingers, for example, connects a book about cats with the RGB memory chips in Lottie's computer. And I can do something with that, right? It's a photograph book about cats. It's got lots of photographs in its memory. And so the point is, as soon as you have two things connected, it's almost like an arc, an electrical spark. You get these ideas leaping between them and people can start doing stuff with them. Tell me what you were saying about literature.
I was too busy enjoying the sort of radio preacher effect. We should do that more interaction with a...
Brothers and sisters! Justin Crowe coming to you from New Canaan.
Yeah, we've been rewatching, in my case, a lot of Carnival, a totally brilliant HBO series that has a lot of Apophenia in it, because it's all about kind of tarot and a larger kind of almost biblical story that plays out in real life. So highly recommended if you haven't seen it. But no, I think we should talk about games, honestly. But Apophenia, particularly the paranoid end of Apophenia, was a real touch point for a lot of postmodern writers. So Pynchon loves it, DeLillo loves it, I believe Ballard loved it, and it was all about creating these sort of essentially bonkers narratives around these protagonists, and it being constantly unclear whether or not the facts actually support it, because you basically have this sort of unreliable third person narrator. And that's one of the big hallmarks of post-modernism in literature, certainly, that there is a sort of unknowable void at the centre of everything. There isn't one objective reality. And as Umberto Eco says, you know, facts, everything means everything, but that also kind of means that everything means nothing, because there is not one specific pattern that really exists. It's the pattern that you make. But that's a bit highfalutin.
So, it is highfalutin, but I think I have mixed feelings about that, because...
About what specifically?
About how the only thing that's real is the unknowable void at the heart of everything, and the meaning is what we make. Because on the one hand, yeah, and the journey getting there can be really interesting. But on the other hand, you know, it's my temptation when I read a book that ends up... And I like Pynchon. I like Pynchon. I've only read Accessible Pynchon. So I love The Crying of Lot 49, which is about exactly all this.
That's the best example. I
got halfway through Bleeding Edge, his most recent, which I
haven't read.
I got halfway through it and I gave up on it, because I could see it was going to the same place. And yeah. I just want to say, well, you know, thanks, Tom. You're a genius and you can write, and there's lots of funny and interesting facts here. But I know where this is going, and I don't really want to go there again, because I feel a little bit like somebody's given me a blank sheet of paper in a really elaborate envelope and then told me, now do you understand? And that's kind of a bullshit response, because it's the journey, not the destination. If you expect every book to have a coded message at the end of it, then you're not a lover of fiction, you're a conspiracy theorist. But at the same time, it is, I think, easy... It is tempting to gesture in that sort of direction and appear profound. It's also tempting to think that somebody is gesturing in that direction, being profound. And this is why you're wrong about David Lynch. Because
well,
you think that's what he does.
He does.
She said very quietly, he does. The microphone might have picked it up.
But I think actually you've touched upon something really that interests me, certainly, about this sort of postmodern stuff. I famously despise Ulysses by James Joyce, who was writing earlier than the postmodernists, but basically influenced everyone who came after him ever. And to be clear, Ulysses is a fantastically brilliant novel. I'm not disparaging the quality of the work whatsoever. It is truly bizarre and amazing and clever. But what gets my goat is the fact that it is presented as a novel, and it patently isn't. If you try and read Ulysses in the same way that you would try and read a Game of Thrones book, or even, you know, a Shakespeare play, you'll want to put your head in a I don't know, colander and smash it with squirrels. It's just, it's incredibly frustrating as a reader's experience. But if you analyse it as a literary critic, then it is a sort of Fabergé egg, and it is beautiful and complicated, and it gives more and more every time you look at it. Very similar to the effect of analysing Chaucer, which was always my go-to as an example of somebody who has so many layers and so many things going on, but you can also on one level just appreciate like a funny story about the wife of Bath having sex with lots of people,
or that man sticks his bum out of the window,
or the man who sticks his bum out of the window, the classic, the Chaucer experience. Whereas James Joyce does not give you the man sticking his bum out of the window in any fun sort of way, and there probably is a man sticking his bum out of the window because Joyce was into that stuff, but it really sort of blossoms under analysis in a way that it really, I think, wilts under a kind of classic entertainment experience. And I think that is also true of the Pynchon and the postmodernists. If you read Gravity's Rainbow, which I have done as a reader, some bits of it are actually sort of intelligible, and he's obviously a brilliant writer and he's doing lots of complicated, interesting literary things, and that's very rewarding and interesting, and I've never read anything like it. But by the second half of the book, frankly, half of it's in German, the protagonist has literally disappeared into the text. and it all gets very complicated and confusing, and it's not really something I think most people can sit down and enjoy. And I'm not saying that people need, you know, linear stories with a villain and a protagonist to enjoy them, but there is an element of those sorts of books I think are not really written to be read, they're written to be studied.
I think, and that's, yeah,
coming back to the Epiphania thing and slightly off my little speaker's corner soapbox, I think if you come wanting to apply a matrix of meaning, those things really shine, but if you come expecting them to bring the meaning to you, then they really struggle.
So I think you've brought out two really good points there, and I think, thank God, they're points that in minute 21 bring you to Indie Games.
Oh, thank God.
And I'm thinking of, so Indie Games.
Yep, we love them. They're good. People should buy them. Well, Steam Summer Sale is currently on.
Because some of them are balls.
Oh, quite a lot of them.
Yeah. But so that's the thing.
Not ours, though.
Well, let
I think.
I'm going to make the assumption that many people listening will have bought at least two Indie Games in their time.
Yeah.
And that at least one Indie Game they've bought will have turned out to have been a gem in the rough or polished.
Yeah.
And they will go away and they'll think, you know, this was made obviously for £8 by 1.5 people, but there's something extraordinary here that I wouldn't have found any other way.
Yeah.
And there's also experience of buying a game which is obviously a sort of similar sized budget and team, but the experience of which, to paraphrase something someone said to me a long time ago, the experience of being lectured to by a twat, or being given a sort of 1990s era GeoCity page disguised as a game and being told that it's really significant. And I think the line between the two is often invisible before you get into it, because often you get diamonds in the rough that you find whole labyrinths inside, and you often get things that look like they might be interesting but turn out to be quite superficial. And of course different people's experiences will vary widely. You know, some people think David Lynch is a charlatan and they're wrong and possibly insane,
and to be clear they're not me.
Yeah, okay, now I know.
Honestly, but yeah,
there's Indie Games that I've adored that other people have thought were dreadful, and vice versa. Because it's there's so many fuzzy edges around what constitutes a game, and people like playing with the boundaries to be able to do it. But what you and I think came to the other day when you're talking about what pretension is, is that if something suggests that it will reward close attention paid to it, and it does, then it's not pretentious.
Yeah,
it might be obscure or difficult or annoying.
Yeah.
But there's something there. If it suggests that close attention should be paid to it, and you pay close attention to it, and that attention is not rewarded, then that is pretentious. And of course, it's one of the difficult things is people at different times on life's journey or with different experiences can find different things in the same texts. So, you know, if you listen to take a wild example, Bon Jovi's Dead or Alive, as my brother did when he was 14 and he adored it. And it really spoke to him in his soul because it has this sort of lonesome cowboy thing. You know, I think when my brother's still with us, if he was now 44, he probably wouldn't have the same reaction to it. But it doesn't mean that 14-year-old's numinous reaction would be invalid. It does mean that the 44-year-old is motivated to say, shut up, kid, you ain't seen nothing. Wait till you've lived the life I have. I can't remember what the other point was. That's the first point about games.
Well, going back to the sort of indies that some people love and some people hate, one of the first things I think about when we talk about Apophenia is a game that almost no one has heard of, but really struck me in a way that many other games haven't. And it's a game called A Dark Room.
I love A Dark Room.
I know you love A Dark Room. So A Dark Room, if you haven't heard it, is a game by a team called Double Speak, I believe, and I think it's still available on iOS and Android.
So you say team, I think it was one person.
Well, it was, I looked into this, it was person who designed it and another person who jointly brought it to mobile.
Gotcha.
So I think we should credit both people. And possibly more people who worked on it, I don't know.
Yeah, I played it on the web before it was on mobile, so I didn't realise.
It was a browser game before it was on mobile, yeah. But we're going with Double Speak games. Mm. And A Dark Room is such a pared-back experience. It really struck me because it was exactly that sense of, like, it's literally made for about £8 and a bag of crisps. But there's so much interesting stuff that is in there that I am required to do with my own brain. So I think the first thing you see is a totally black screen, and then some really old-fashioned white text appears that literally says, you are in a dark room, and that's it. That's where you begin. There's no UI, there's no FMV, there's no sort of introduction that tells you what the heck is going on. And you figure out pretty quickly that there are some very pared back controls that allow you to interact with the world. And it's essentially a sort of resource gathering game initially. But then you realise that things are slightly changing, and actually the narrative does some pretty surprising and brilliant things, even though all you're doing is you know, these repeated actions in a very pared back stage. So I think this is a great example of something that you then went on to do a lot with in Cultist Simulator, which is basically ask the player to connect the dots themselves. You didn't say it's a sort of show don't tell experience, and you didn't say Cultist Simulator is set in the 1920s and therefore we're going to have a big animated intro sequence where we see a man in a robe entering the underground crypt of a church at night.
500 years ago the Ordolithi began their machinations,
and then squids in the background. No, we didn't do any of that. What we did was give you a blank tabletop and some cards. And that immediately puts a lot of emphasis on the player. And some players don't like that, because what they want is a probably more relaxing experience where the game says, you know, here's what you do, here's what you love, here's more of what you love, right? And that's fine. But I think a lot of players are really engaged by the fact that the game says, I'm not going to do all this work. You're going to have to work with me. It's kind of a cooperative effort to make this game work, which is obviously brilliant for indies on a budget. And that's something that A Dark Room does incredibly well before we made Cultist. So I think they should get props.
I agree, and I love it. And I want to talk briefly about Stephen Donaldson, who was a epic fantasy author who was huge in the 80s and is often overlooked now.
Yeah, I've never heard of him.
Two extremely heavy trilogies, and I mean, you know, if we had both of these trilogies next to us now, they probably weigh about as much as you.
Oh, you mean literally heavy? You don't mean like heavy. Full of serious subject matter?
No. I mean 600 pages and up.
Oh God!
And they're Stephen Donaldson takes himself extremely seriously, and is a man of considerable talent. And the books are about a leper. I mean, he's a literal leper. He's living in contemporary America, but he's lost some of his hand and all of his marriage to leprosy. And he ends up being transported to another place where he has power and is relevant and is not a leper. At the end of every book, initially, he has to come back and deal with it. So it's a weird mix, because it's brilliantly imaginative and some of the writing's really powerful. But also it's kind of flabby. And a lot of it is massively over the top. And those people of my age will know that Stephen Donaldson was chiefly known, and bless him, mocked for using really obscure words.
I thought this was him. Yeah. You've mentioned him
so
before.
Argute, for example.
Argute?
Argute, or gerid.
What?
The most archetypical quote, I think, from Donaldson was, they were lambent and telic like gangrene. They looked horribly like children. Now, that's actually, I really, telic means it possesses purpose, like teleology. Lambent obviously means shining.
Yeah.
So you can really see what he's trying to do there. But unfortunately, it, you know, sort of comes out as if it's been in a washing machine. It's just, the effect is unfortunate. So these were sort of a couple of Donaldson's defining characteristics, is he was extremely imaginative, extremely prolific, and also didn't have much of their self-discipline. But he had a collection of short stories, which were in the main really good, and where he sort of quelled a lot of his temptations. And in fact, I think he showed a lot of self-awareness in the foreword, where he said, if you're writing a novel and you want people to get what you're after, what you're talking about, you can sort of stand off and like hose them down with words and you'll soak them head to toe. And so obviously some of the words will stick. But if you're writing a short story, you've only got a limited amount of time and attention. So you have to like stand up really close to them and like put the words in their pocket or their hat band
to make
sure they stick. And I think that's the thing about games with an apophenic quality is it, you know, if you make a AAA game, you could hose somebody down. Mm. You can have a person whose entire job is to make the cape flap right. So it's all a very immersive experience. But if you're making a game that is all about connecting very few dots, you need to be incredibly careful when you place those few dots. You need to make sure that people draw the lines between the dots.
Yeah.
They can put things together that you intended or hoped they put together. Because otherwise you end up, you know, lecturing like a twat.
That's interesting, because I'm also aware that one of the things that you learned as in your past life as a teacher is that if you really want people to listen, you don't shout, you speak quieter, because then people think it's really annoying to not hear properly.
Works better with adults than with children, I have to say.
Okay, but you know, that's slightly counterintuitive for someone like me who's never had to learn how to basically crowd control. And that sort of feels like apophenia as well. We're not saying, you know, here is a bombastic opening and here's lots of money thrown at all this stuff that is admittedly beautiful and amazing. I'm not disparaging games that do this, but the effect is just a fundamentally different thing, that the player essentially leans in closer and thinks about it.
I hadn't thought,
rather than settling back in with the popcorn and their, you know, controller. And I think that can be a really fantastically absorbing experience. I mean, another game I was going to mention was Return of the Obra Dinn, which is a slightly different form of pattern recognition, because it does actually have, you know, a graphical interface, even though it's quite stylized and uses a limited color palette and all this kind of stuff. It's another kind of pared back game. But you do understand where you are and what you're doing, and you are navigating a 3D game space. For those of you who haven't played it, firstly, why haven't you played it? It's Lucas Pope, come on. But you are, I think, an insurance investigator who is on, I think, like an 18th century, like, cutter, like a ship, and you're basically looking around the ship trying to discover what's happened to all the missing crew members. And there's a particular mechanic that enables some interesting jumps between different scenes, but all of the game takes place on this one ship. And your role as the player is to basically look at certain dioramas and look at certain situations and draw inferences from what is displayed, and then basically figure out a puzzle in your own head of what happened and who did this and how did that occur. And the game does not give you all of the pieces. You really have to draw the dots yourself, and that means that people got a real kick out of it, because you really felt you were sort of dealing with this meaty problem that was also presented in a gamey way. So it was kind of like maths, in the way that when you do like maths that anyone can do, you know, like, and I'm talking about anyone individually, because I know people have different abilities, and I certainly am not a mathematician, but when you have a sum that you've done and you know it's right, you do get this kind of quite meaty satisfaction, because like, that is the correct answer and I have done that, and they're like, mwah, delicious. And that's the same effect of this kind of very specific connecting the dots that Pope gives you.
I think that is different. I think we've strayed, because I pointed to that direction. There's a difference between apophenia and economy, because if I remember correctly, Pope spent 4 or 5 years making Obra Dinn, and he ended up rewriting a lot of the code base and also reworking a lot of the story, because it had all to fit together like a puzzle. And you get that satisfaction from putting the pieces together. You're right. And I think you don't generally get that satisfaction from an apophony, only from an epiphany. And
That was nicely done.
Thank you. And Obra Dinn is a series of epiphanies. And I think, you know, a game does not need to be one or the other. Cultist Simulator, for example, has a number of intentional epiphanies where you will put together facts or mechanics and go, ooh. And it also has a lot of intentionally fuzzy, deliberately ambiguous meaning around the boundaries where apophanies can flourish, like little flowers.
Why would you want an apophany as a designer?
So there's I'm going to give you a continuum, and at one end of the continuum is something very idealistic, and the other is something very cynical. Which one do you want first?
I would like the idealistic one first, please.
Idealistic one is that the more apophanic your game, the more you are inviting the player into your space to co-create meaning with you, and that it becomes much more like a dialogue between the player and the game maker, and the player owns the experience in a way they don't when the experience is pre-packaged and provided to them.
And the cynical?
It's cheap. You give people a stick and a ball and you say, make your own meaning. And they're like, ooh, it's like the earth has been struck by a meteorite. And you practice it. And okay, so that's the thing, is genuinely, as an indie, and I've given...
I believe that's what we call in marketing terms... leaning into your limitations, we're bloody cheap.
Exactly, and to step back from the joke. Obviously, I'm not fucking cynical about this stuff. If I was making games and I was cynical, then I'd be doing free to play. So really, what I want is to be able to use to lean into our limitations and to provide people with an experience that rewards them, because the more they dig, the more they find, and sometimes they find meanings that weren't consciously there, but were further along the road I might have travelled. I saw people talking about the winter aspect in Cultist, which you in fact designed.
I did.
And they discussed possible meanings they found in it, and I think sort of 5 out of the 6 meanings that you put in there were, that they mentioned were intentional, but the sixth wasn't. So somebody said it reminded them of an ellipsis because it's 3 dots.
So if everyone's listening who hasn't played Cultist Simulator, the winter aspect is a very small icon which shows, and I'm just describing it exactly as it is, not as what it's meant to represent. It's a circle, and in that circle are 3 small crosses in a triangle. There's a sort of small cross at the top, there's a small cross at the bottom left, and there's a small cross at the bottom right. And it is deliberately meant to look like a number of things. And you can only do that by pairing it back. If I'd coloured it in a lot more carefully or drawn a much more detailed line drawing, it would have increasingly looked like one thing rather than the other. And AK was very kind and pointed out this lovely Reddit thread this morning where people were saying, I thought it looked like this, or this spoke to me. And that's exactly the process of people bringing their own kind of patterns and pattern recognition to something that we provided.
And I think that's a really good example because, so first of all, it's 3 dots that you draw connections between. Oh, lol. but also, I remember us talking about it. That was the last of the aspects to be designed. I think most of the other primary aspect icons, Catherine Unger, didn't she? We needed an extra one for
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. But we went back and forth on it, and you were worried that it wasn't expressive enough, and we changed it about a bit and chose the colour. So although it's really simple, an unexpected amount of work went into it, and it's bloody delightful to see people understanding some of the intentional connections 4 years after the fact.
Yeah.
So when I say there's a continuum between the cynical and the idealistic, to be absolutely serious, I'm way down towards the idealistic end. But obviously an apophenic approach, if you can do it right, is cheaper. I've talked about poetic design, I've talked about apophenian design, that's all part of it. And it's not like I have a department downstairs of 30 3D artists who are sort of champing at the bit to be allowed into the game. We're like, no, we're going to hold it back to allow the players to be created. Basically, we're 2 people in a room, we need to work with what we have.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a very nice way to end. We haven't got a team of 3D artists in the basement. We lean ideologically into paired back stuff and into trusting our players, and you as a designer have a dialogue with them.
I think we'd be more comfortable saying we can neither confirm nor deny that we have a team of 3D artists in the basement.
All right. Well, I'm sure if you're listening to this, you have thought of other examples that you're shouting at whatever device you're using to listen to this podcast and saying, you should talk about game X or Y. So do let us know if you have any other apophenic game examples.
I'd be really interested. I'd be really interested.
But I think that's where we'll leave it. So thank you very much for listening. Buy Console Simulator in the Steam sale.
And my book.
And Alexis's book called...
If I can't plug my book on the podcast, when can I plug my book?
Plug the book.
It's called Against World Building. So people keep writing to me. Now I've had three separate emails from people that basically said, I'm really sorry, I'm doing world building and I kind of feel a bit silly now.
Have you?
Yeah, I mean, all of them are intelligent people who've said, I basically, you know, I do world building for my TRPG because I enjoy doing it.
That's the thing,
but
yeah.
I kind of feel like I want to... if you are doing world building for your TRPG... Then please, I apologise for you for suggesting you do anything wrong. I was talking about something really specific, but you have to buy the book to understand that.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Have a spooky day.
People will think the podcast broke.
Yeah, they will. Okay, I was being apophenic. Have a spooky day.